I just want to talk about an aspect of Pesach that we usually don't get to before Pesach. So I think it's good to talk about it today. And that is what we commemorate the last days of Pesach, which is the splitting of the Yom Suf. Just a few words about the splitting of the Yom Suf. First, there's a beautiful word from the Vilna Gaon. And maybe you notice when they were reading the Shiva Sayam, there's one pasuk that is repeated twice with a slightly different wording. It says, the first pasuk says, "Vayavo b'nei Yisrael b'soch hayam, b'yabasha b'soch hayam." Right, b'nei Yisrael went into the dry land that was the ocean. V'hamayim lehem choma, and the water was a wall on their right, miminam u'mismolam. And the word choma is spelt in the Torah without a vav. So it could be read as chema. There was anger against the Jewish people. What was the anger against the Jewish people? So Chazal say that Hashem was debating whether the Jewish people are deserving of being saved. Because the angel said to God, Ma nishtanu elu me'elu. Why is one group better than the other group? The Egyptians are idol worshippers, and the Jews are idol worshippers. Why are they deserving of being saved? And God had to think about it, till, of course, he decided to save B'nai Israel.
But the slaves didn't have time to idols to worship idols. They didn't worship
idols. No, in Mitzrayim they were of the Avodah Zarah. They
even the slaves?
They definitely were.
Who was angry?
Well, it says Hashem had an anger against B'nai Israel because of what the Malachi Hashareis told him.
Oh, because of the Ramayim. So it doesn't refer to the Ramayim.
No, the water wasn't angry, but...
When they were in the water,
there was a chema in Shemayim. Now, a few psukim later, it says, "V'yavo b'nei Yisrael b'toch hayam b'yabasha." So it doesn't say yabasha b'soch hayam, but it says "v'soch hayam b'yabasha." So why does it switch the order? And then it says again, "Hamayim lahem choma." The water was a wall, miminam u'mismolam, from their right and from their left. But here the word choma is not spelt with a minus a vav. It is spelt with a vav, so it could only have one meaning, a wall, not anger. So, number one, why is the same pasuk repeated twice, essentially? Number two, why does the first pasuk say, b'yabasha b'soch hayam, and then the second pasuk says, Bayam Biyabasha. And third, why is the double entendre that you infer from the absence of a vav, chema, choma, only appear in the first pasuk and does not appear in the second pasuk? So the Vilna Gaon says a beautiful answer that answers all of these questions in one fell swoop. And he says, the two psukim are referring to two different groups of people. We know that most of the Jewish people did not have faith in Hashem. Most of the Jewish people were afraid to jump into the Yam Suf. They were afraid they would drown. They did not believe Hashem would save them. However, there were some unique individuals who had the faith to have such faith in HaKadosh Baruch Hu that they were willing to jump in knowing that Hashem would save them. These are, of course, Nachshon ben Aminadav, the head of the tribe of Yehuda, and Shevet Binyamin, we are also told, went in. So the Vilna Gaon says this is very meduyak. The first pasuk, which says, V'yavo b'nei Yisrael b'yabasha b'soch hayam, refers to those people who did not jump in until they saw dry land. They waited until Nachshon went in. Those people lacked emunah. Those people didn't go in until there was a yabasha. For those people, there is indeed chema. God says, why are you better than the Egyptians? You don't have faith in me. The second pasuk is very different. The second pasuk says, V'yavo b'nei Yisrael l'soch hayam b'yabasha. Meaning, they went into the ocean, which then became dry land. Which people are those? That's Nachshon ben Aminadav and the tribe of Binyamin. For those people, we're not going to say chema, that God had some anger. What do you mean, how are you different than the Egyptians? They're very different than the Egyptians. They demonstrated emunah in HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So the Vilna Gaon says, therefore, that these two psukim are not redundant, but rather they expressed the fact that there were most of the Jewish people lacked faith and they had to see the splitting of the sea before they went in. Moshe Ein Kein, Nachshon, went in first. And that's why it's very meduyak why when Hashem commanded the Jewish people to go into the sea, or told Moshe to tell them to go see, he says, V'yavo b'nei Yisrael v'sochayam v'yabasha. The commandment was they should have the faith. And they did not. And in fact, the B'nai Yisrael brings, a famous Hasidic sefer, that it was the minog in Europe, or at least in Hungary, that all positions of authority, all communal positions of authority, in terms of who would lead a Jewish congregation, or a Bikur Cholim, or Chevra Kadisha, these appointments were historically made on the seventh day of Pesach. And he says the significance is because the seventh day of Pesach, Chazal actually say, the reason why Malchus, kingship, was descended from Nachshon ben Aminadav was because of his act of self-sacrifice in going into the Yamsuf. And even the temporary transitional Malchus that was given to Shaul HaMelech from Shevet Binyamin is a function of that Mesiras Nefesh of Shevet Binyamin. And therefore, the seventh day of Pesach was in itself the basis for appointment to high office, and it also reminds our leaders that the condition to being successful in one's office is a sense of devotion and self-sacrifice for the cause. In other words, you want to be a leader, your role model is Nachshon ben Aminadav and Shevet Binyamin. That's how he says there was actually a minhag that these appointments were made on the seventh day of Pesach. And that's the notion, therefore, of those who had emuna went in up to their necks in the water. In fact, by the way, I once heard from a shadchan in a singles convention that, you know, Chazal say that Hashem making marriages is as difficult as the Yamsuf. And there are a lot of different interpretations. Why do we compare Shiduchim to the Yamsuf? So this person gave the interpretation because just like the Yamsuf, the sea didn't split until you were willing to take the risk of getting up to your neck in water. And sometimes a person says, I don't want to pursue something unless I'm sure that it's 100% perfect. You're not willing to take a chance. You're not willing to be vulnerable. The comparison to Kriyas Yamsuf says you have to have emuna, that you have to be willing to take a risk and take a chance. And if one is not going to let oneself be open to that, the sea is not going to split. That's one pshat I heard. I heard another pshat, again it's a drush, that, you know, according to the Medrash, Kriyas Yamsuf was a strange phenomenon. They really, at whatever point the crossing was, it was obviously not the Red Sea, but whatever it would have been, the Gulf of Suez or whatever, but Chazal say it was actually not a total crossing, but rather they went into a semicircle, and they came out on the same side that they entered, but slightly south of where they were. Semicircle. Not only that, but there's a Midrashic interpretation that says each tribe had its own path. There were actually 12 distinct semi-concentric half circles in which they emerged. So according to this, there's actually a very difficult timing situation. Because obviously if you have 12 concentric circles, the path of the circumference is greatly lessened for the people. Again, the way the Torah sets it up is there was a cloud of glory that was blocking the Egyptians until the Jews came through. How did that work? There were like 12 different clouds of glory for each, because each path was a different time. But what it does show you is that those in the inner circle had less of a path to cross than those in the outer circle. So the comparison to a shidduch is some people have a longer way to go than others, but if you have emuna, you do come out on the right side. So that's another lesson.
Some
of that.
Some people don't think it at all.
Well,
why
again,
is it a circle, Rabbi? Because if you go according to the circle, they
came out on the same side,
right.
but not at the same point. In other words,
right.
An arc. It was an arc.
Right.
In other words, they entered.
Is that really how it happened?
That's what the Medrash says, you know, again, at least there's an opinion in the Medrash that says
that. They had that in the newspaper.
Yes, it was in the newspaper.
It was in both?
Yeah.
Right, somebody told me about that, yeah. It quoted the Medrash or it used the
Medrash? No, it
read
it in the Haggadah.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. All right, that probably is based on the Medrash.
The one about the Sephardic group, the end Sephardic Haggadah. Yeah.
Right. In fact, he gives, somebody told me he gives a weekly shiur in, what, Jewish history and maps or something.
Right.
Yeah, that's very interesting. Again, it's interesting, and, you know, the Haggadah undoubtedly got it from the Midrashic account. The Midrash actually says that it was concentric arcs, and they emerged on the same side, and each shevet had its own distinct path, which, of course, is a great metaphor for the notion of individuality. Each person has their path to redemption. It's not the same, and some get it relatively easy, and some get it through greater struggle. Right? That's the whole metaphor for that idea. But this is one idea of the Kriyas, of Kriyas Yamsef.
So Lord, yep. They
in other words, why would they have to go back to the same? I don't know. I don't know exactly what the purpose would have been. I don't know, because the only thing the Torah tells us is that HaKadosh Baruch Hu did not take us, you know, due north along the Mediterranean coast. The Torah does tell us that because we would have encountered the Plishtim who dwelt on the Mediterranean coast, and our early encounter with the Plishtim would have so discouraged us and demoralized us. We would have gone back to Mitzrayim, and that's why we had to go south across that part of the Dead Sea. The Red Sea, and bring us, but of course that would bring us to the Sinai. So l'chara, there is a question, why did we have to go back and go around? We could have, and I don't know exactly what the cheshbon would be, but this is what the Midrash says. I know Chazal teach us that's what he said, okay, that I didn't hear, but B'nai Ephraim, as you know, they did leave 30 years earlier because they made a cheshbon. In fact, we talked about this discrepancy because HaKadosh Baruch Hu told Abraham that your children will be enslaved 400 years. Now, the truth of the matter is the B'nai Ephraim figured that was 400 years from the time the covenant was made to Abraham. In fact, the 400 years runs from the birth of Yitzchak, that was 30 years later. And that's why it says they left 430 years from the covenant. The Bnei Ephraim, therefore, jumped the gun. They left Egypt 30 years earlier on their own, and they were destroyed by their enemies. But that part I didn't hear, but you're saying that Ma'am Lois brings that Hashem didn't want Bnei Israel to see the bodies of the Bnei Ephraim. You know, it's interesting, there is a medrash that says that the bones that Yechezkel revived, the famous Nevuah of Yechezkel, were in fact those B'nai Ephraim who died prematurely, and that is in effect showing us that they will eventually also come back and join Klal Yisrael. And in fact, there is one opinion in the Gemara that says Yechezkel's whole thing was an imaginary, it was just a dream or a vision, it was not something that he was actually doing. But at the point that he said that, Rabbi Yehuda ben Baseira got up, and a certain rabbi was saying, this is a dream that didn't really happen, it was only a prophetic vision. So Yehuda ben Baseira got up and said, I am a descendant of those people that Yechezkel revived, and they went and they had kids, and these are the tefillin that I got, you know, from my great-great-great-grandfather. So some learned that not only did Yechezkel revive them, but in fact they remained alive, and they joined Klal Yisrael. But that was much later. At that time, they were still dead bodies. So that's one thing about Kriyas Yamsef. Now, we know this. We know that another Chazal that says... Well, let me talk about this first. Now, the question is, so we find that by Kriyas Yamsef, the angels were arguing with Hashem, Ma nishtanu elu mi'elu? Why save the Jews and kill the Egyptians? The Jews are no better than the Egyptians. Now, the Meshech Chachma asks a very good question. He says, the Jews had just gone through the whole experience of Yetzias Mitzrayim when there were 10 plagues. Every one of those plagues only affected the Jews, the Egyptians, and did not affect the Jews. Huh? Four-fifths of the Jews. Yeah, that's true. Four-fifths of the Jews did. Yeah, that's correct. However, keep in mind that when God is saying that the Jews are no better than the Egyptians, he's referring to the one-fifth that were saved. Even they were not so good. So the question becomes, how come, and certainly until you get to Choshech, the Jews were not affected, right? Dan, Svardaya. How come we don't find the angels complaining to God and saying, hey, why are the Jews so bad? The Jews are good and the Egyptians so bad? Manishtanu Eilu Mielu. The Kitruk. Kitruk, the prosecution, the accusation, the sense that the Jews are not deserving, that only surfaces by Kriyas Yamsuf, that did not surface by the Makos themselves. And he says a beautiful thought that we can think about during Sefiras HaOmer. And he says, you know, Chazal teach us that the Jews in Mitzrayim were on a very low level, actually. They were on the 49th level of impurity. They had to be taken out 190 years early, because if they would have stayed a little bit longer, they would have hit level number 50. They would have been irredeemable. Ad kedei kach, that the meaning, the Ari writes, they couldn't let their dough rise, was that the few minutes that it would take to let their dough rise, we don't even know what that means, they would have hit the 50th level. And the 50th level, there would have been no hope. They had to leave 190 years earlier. Now, here is the thing. They were over there, Avodah Zarah. The Jews worshipped idols in Mitzrayim. The only tribe that did not was the tribe of Levi, who were not enslaved. The Jews stopped practicing circumcision until the Korban Pesach. They did not do Bris Milah. They were Ovdei Avodah Zarah, whatever other mitzvahs they had. I mean, they didn't have other mitzvahs, basically. So the Jews were not religious in any sense. And they were not even faithfully worshipping Hashem, other than the tribe of Levi. Now, and that's why in the Navi Yecheskel, they are described as a naked, abandoned child. Naked, at Arum Ve'eria. Why are they naked? They are naked from all the mitzvahs. And Hashem gave them the mitzvahs of blood, the Domayech Chayi, and Chazal Darshan, that the mitzvahs that gave them the ability to be redeemed were the mitzvah of the blood of the Korban Pesach and the blood of the Bris Milah. B'damayich chayi. We say this in the Haggadah, with your blood you shall live. Damayich is plural, your bloods you shall live. However, in order for them to even get that Dam Pesach and Dam Milah, there had to have been some foundational zechus that they had. And we discussed the last time before Pesach, that the minimal zechusim that they did have were, they didn't change their names, they didn't change their language, according to some they didn't intermarry, they didn't speak Lashon Hara against each other. These are different lists, and they didn't change their clothing. Now, we think about this, it's a funny type of thing. You know, it's a whole debate in Israel now, it's actually a very interesting debate. Between secular and whether Israel should be a Jewish state or a state of the Jews. It's a very big debate. I mean, unfortunately, the direction of many in the left wing of Israel is that the whole concept of a Jewish state, forget about religious state, that's a separate issue, but the notion of a Jewish state is fundamentally inconsistent with the notion of democracy, and therefore Israel is a state of the Jews, in which Jews are a majority of the population, in a sense that America might be a state of Protestants, but it's not a Protestant state. And it's interesting that, you know, just like we darshan the Torah, we make, you know, so they're darshan, the written Torah of secular Zionism is Herzl, Theodor Herzl's book, The Jewish State, and there's a whole big machlokas, how do you translate the German Judenstadt? Apparently there's some linguistic problem there. Is it the Jewish state, or is it state of the Jews? That's very important, because whatever Herzl called his book defines what Zionism is. So they're bringing all sorts of proofs from the French translations and the English translations and the Hebrew translations, although it's an interesting irony that the Hebrew translation of Herzl's book is Medinat HaYehudim, which means state of the Jews. The English translation of the book is the Jewish state. So, you know, it's very crazy how to, you know, what they're trying to prove here. But the issue is this. The issue is that, you know, we look at people and we say, well, somebody goes by a Hebrew name, like, big deal, doesn't keep Shabbos, doesn't keep kosher, somebody wears a Magen David. Do these things count for anything? Now let's consider for a moment the situation in Mitzrayim. The Jews were idol worshippers. The Jews were not even practicing circumcision. But they went by a Hebrew name. Why on earth would that have any importance at all? And what you see from this Chazal is a very, very important lesson. That if a person identifies themselves as a Jew, if a person wants to be part of the Jewish people, if a person rejoices in the joys of the Jewish people and suffers in the suffering of the Jewish people, that is not the end point of being a Jew. That's not the ultimate purpose. The purpose of Yetzias Mitzrayim is Matan Torah. But that is the foundation from which redemption can come. That there is intrinsically a religious value in identifying yourself as a Jew. even if it does not translate into mitzvahs, it does not translate into even faith in Hashem, it means something because you're part of HaKadosh Baruch Hu's people. And you want to be identified as, you know, I was thinking, you know, sometimes you see a kosher style restaurant. And I remember in Chicago, I still remember this because it was such an absurdity to me. I was walking by a treif restaurant in Chicago, and they put up a sign that says, "We serve chalent on Shabbos." So I'm thinking to myself, some person walks in, he probably orders, you know, non-kosher wine to say Bray Priya Geffen over, and you're eating treif cholent on Shabbos, and you pay for it. Like, you know, what on earth, what possible value could that have? I think maybe it has some value. You know, we don't know, Hashem judges. But a person says, you know, I don't keep mitzvahs, I'm not into that stuff. But I want to proclaim in an open way that I'm a Jewish person. Again, that's not the end, but it is the beginning. Okay, people often mistrust that, you know, when the Soviets, when they used to have the rallies for Soviet Jewry, so they would always quote the pasuk, "Let my people go." Now, first of all, it doesn't say "let my people go," it says "shalach ami," send my people. But they always leave out the end of the verse, "shalach ami v'yavduni," let my people go, or send my people away, so that they will worship me. They always put an ellipsis, they put three dots after "let my people go." I mean, the point is, as Pesach and Shavuos indicate, freedom has to be linked to submission to Hashem. So there's no question the tachlis of Yetzias Mitzrayim is Matan Torah. So we're not saying it's enough to identify yourself as a gastronomic Jew or whatever you call it, or a Jewish heart, cardiac Jew. But that also means to say that there is some value in that as well. That is a foundation, that is a beginning. One's love for the Jewish people, one's desire to be connected to the Jewish people, even by language, by ethnic ties, by language, by name, by dress.
There are a lot of Jews who identify in terms of the Holocaust.
Right. Well, those things have value. They are beginnings. So the Meshech Chachma says the following. When Jewish people are unified with love and respect and caring for each other, they form a whole that is greater than the sum of their individual parts. So even if each individual Jew is defective in their service to God, they become part of a whole. So the Meshech Chachma says, you know why in Mitzrayim there was no kitrug, there was no prosecution, there was no accusation? Because even though most of the Jews were Ovdei Avodah Zarah, the unity and love that was manifest by common language, common clothing, not speaking Lashon Hara, not turning each other in, not intermarrying, was enough to make them a beneficiary of God's connection to Klal Yisrael as a whole, which was greater than the flaws and failings of every individual. Yes, every individual was deficient, but they were part of a unified whole. Now, there's a beautiful statement in Avastar Rav Nasa that says the following. You know, there's a whole list of how you should emulate Hashem's ways. So it says like this. It says, be like God, just like God is merciful, etc. That Chazal say. But in Avastar Rav Nasa, it adds a very strange item to the list. It says, just like Hashem is Sameach B'chelka, God is happy with what he has. God is happy with his chelik. So you should be happy with your chelik. Sameach B'chelka. So at first glance, that makes no sense. I mean, God has everything. If I had everything, I'd be happy too. I mean, no. God is happy with what he has. I'm happy. I should be happy with what I have. I mean, Hashem has everything. So I think the Vilna Gaon says like this. What is the real chelik of Hashem, the Jewish people? It says in Hazinu, Ki chelik Hashem, Amo, God's portion is his people. Sameach b'chelko means HaKadosh Baruch Hu gets a lot of nachas and satisfaction from the Jewish people. Well, a parent also punishes a child. A parent punishes a child, but it doesn't mean you don't get nachas. Hashem gets much nachas and satisfaction from his people. He is Sameach b'chelko in spite of our faults, in spite of our mistakes. And therefore we also have to cultivate the midah of being Sameach b'chelka. So it turns out the Meshech Chachma says that in Mitzrayim, in spite of the personal shortcomings of the people, because there was that unity and togetherness, that allowed Hashem to overlook the individual failings of the person, because you link yourself to a unit that is greater than the sum of the constituent parts. Even if every constituent part is defective in large part, the whole is greater. Now, what happened by Kriyas Yamsuf? Yes, that's exactly what we're saying. That the reason is because a person as an individual will never have a complete... No, well, again... But the counterbalance to that is to understand that this was a foundation. Now again, look at Mitzrayim itself. This was the foundation which enabled Hashem to then give us specific mitzvot of Pesach and Milah, by which we achieve redemption. Meaning, it wouldn't have got us redemption alone. It was a foundation on which Hashem could construct an edifice. But Hashem would not have given us Pesach and Milah had we not had that achdus. And also, the point is, the purpose of Yetzias Mitzrayim was Matan Torah. So, the way we would describe this is, it is a necessary but not sufficient condition. But it is a necessary condition, and that's something for people to remember. So people, for example, who will emphasize only their mitzvahs between man and God, without trying to create that unity, will not be worthy of redemption either. Now, let's go to Kriyas Yamsuf. So what happened by Kriyas Yamsuf? By Kriyas Yamsuf, there's an interesting chazal that say that the Jewish people split into four groups. One group said, let's jump into the ocean, not because they thought it would split. Let's jump into the ocean, let's commit suicide. We're so afraid. Let's just commit suicide, finish ourselves off. The second group said, let us return to Egypt and capitulate. Let us surrender. And a third group said, let us wage war. And a fourth group said, let us call out to the nations of the world for protection. Let's call to the UN to come in and a multinational
not
force.
God, but...
to come and help us. Now, if you recall, the way the Medrash concludes, Hashem told Moshe each of these responses was incorrect. That's why we infer what they were saying from what Hashem told Moshe. Hisyatzvu uru, stand still and see the salvation of God. That's directed to the people that said, let's jump into the ocean. As you see the Egyptians today, you'll never see them again. That's directed to those who want to surrender. God will fight for you. That's directed to those who wanted to wage war. You will be silent. That's directed to those who wanted to call out to the nations of the world. Now, the Meshech Chachma learns like this. Meshech Chachma learns, these are not simply four different responses, but it represents a symbolic disintegration of a common unity that existed in Mitzrayim, where each person is now looking after his own survival strategy. At that point, the unity doesn't exist. It's each person for himself. Well, there's a mida keneged mida here, and that is, if you separate yourself from the klal, and you seek to maximize your own personal benefit, then HaKadosh Baruch Hu looks at us as individuals. As individuals, the angels could point out, he's an idol worshiper, he's a mechalel Shabbos, doesn't do bris milah. Meaning the concept here is, this is the Meshech Chachma's Yisod, that when there was that unity and togetherness, to some degree, and again, we can't say totally, but to some degree, Hashem overlooks the individual faults of a person because you connect yourself to a cloud. When you disassociate yourself from a cloud, then your individual faults come to the forefront. Again, this comes up in many, many areas. Machdus HaShekel, right? Half Shekel. The notion is that by myself, I am incomplete. A half becomes a whole only when it is connected to another half. That is the lesson of Achdus and unity and Machzus HaShekel. Right? And this is brought out by Kriyas Yamsuf itself. And in fact, Rashi brings it an earlier point in the Torah. Rashi points out, why was the generation of the flood totally wiped out? But the Tower of Babel, the Migdol Bavel, they were dispersed, but they were allowed to continue and flourish. So Rashi says, because the generation of the flood were totally corrupted in their relationships with each other. Violence, theft, murder. The Dor HaFlaga, they were denying the existence of God. Again, what they were trying to do is not at all clear, but they were either defying God or denying God, or they wanted technology to conquer the world. Actually, Vance Napshus, I believe, says Migdol Bavel was a rocket. He says they had a rocket technology that they were trying to do. It was like a launching pad. But whatever it was a rebellion against God that was accompanied with a sense of unity and common purpose. There was shalom. So God had to disperse them because that shalom was destructive.
So he divided
them. That's why he divided them. But the very fact that there was shalom actually worked to their merits, because it gave them the zechus of being alive, of staying alive. So this is the idea of Gadol HaShalom, the greatness of shalom, the greatness of unity. And therefore it's a real reminder to us that that when there is shalom and love and togetherness among Klal Yisrael, it is a tremendous source of merit, even in a community that might be full of averos and full of evil. Because in Mitzrayim it protected us. It did not protect us by the Kriyas Yamsef. And that is why the kitruv, the prosecution, the accusation, only materializes by Kriyas Yamsef. It did not materialize by the Ten Makas. Actually, it's an interesting point. Many Mephoshim say that in Mitzrayim, it was precisely the slavery experience itself that brought people together as they shared this common suffering and the like. Ironically, the new gift of freedom that they get could actually give a person a greater sense of autonomy and individuality, which under crisis then disintegrates into selfishness and egotism. Right? It actually is the freedom itself resides from them. Without having that faith in Hashem. In fact, as we know, this is actually this is actually a major crisis that Israeli society is going through right now. And that is, ironically, in some ways, as Israel is in less of what you might call an absolute acute crisis situation. I mean, they're in a chronic crisis situation. But the reservoirs of self-sacrifice are not called upon as often. And as a result, there is much greater less cohesiveness. There is a greater selfishness and egotism that permeates, this is what the Israelis say, that permeates Israeli society than the earlier idealistic days of draining the swamps and all of that. I mean, Zionism was, at one point, in spite of its religious aberrations, was a profoundly idealistic movement of self-sacrifice and commitment and the like. You know, read Golda Meir's autobiography of what life was like in the kibbutzim of the 1920s. It's very, really hard life. But, you know, they had this goal and they had this dream and they pursued it. Today, it would be very hard pressed to find an Israeli that would, you know, drain a swamp. I mean, it's not what you do. You know, go to New York or something. But, and it actually ties into the notion that as greater freedom and opportunity comes, we sometimes lose that sense of a shared commitment to a goal. Yeah. Oedipus? Exactly it.
How do you make a connection? What do we have in the world? Is there some connection that we use?
Yeah. Well, why you say it at a bris is very clear, because B'damaya Chayi is both a reference to the blood of the Korban Pesach and the blood of the bris milah that was given at the same time. Because remember, before they brought the Korban Pesach, the man had to do a bris. Now, the question is, what do you do with the girl? Well, again, there are different minhagim regarding naming ceremonies for girls, as you know. And by the way, it's not just an avant-garde thing. I mean, Sfardim has had for hundreds of years special ceremonies. But if you ask what blood mitzvah applies, you know, the answer is obvious. And indeed, there is a medrash that does say that Dam Nida and the observances of the laws of Nida is connected to the notion of serving God with the blood. There is indeed a connection. And again, the concept of serving God with blood is very significant, because if you remember yesterday's Torah reading, there's a constant reiteration that blood is the life force of every living creature. Blood is the life, dam hu nefesh, and therefore the notion of serving God with our blood literally means it's a metaphor for surrendering one's very vital existence to the service of Hashem. So dam nida does correlate to dam pesach and dam mila. Yeah. Although, as far as I know, the pasuk itself is not quoted in connection with those rituals, but the idea is certainly there. Well, there are five components of the soul, and the nefesh, which is the biological soul, that is embedded in the blood. Ki adam hu nefesh. There is nefesh, ruach, neshama, chaya, yechida. Nefesh is the basic biological soul, and that is in the blood itself. That's right. Well, Nachshon is the fifth response. That's right. The four responses are those that HaKadosh Baruch Hu criticized. Nachshon represents the response of total faith in HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Nachshon also jumped in. Huh?
But he was the first.
Well, he was one person, but Shevet Binyamin also. Shevet Binyamin did it as well. The whole tribe of Binyamin. Yeah, Nachshon was the first. Shevet Binyamin followed. Then the water split. So then they walk in. They didn't jump in. They walked in. Yeah. So the concept was that those that have emuna brought the Yeshua to Klal Yisrael.
Why is the response of fighting the Egyptians criticized later in the Midbar? Fighting the enemies.
Yeah. Well, the truth is, you see a lot of things. First of all, you even see that Hashem complains they shouldn't even daven to Him, right? It's not just don't cry to the nations of the world. Hashem says to Moshe in almost annoyance, "Ma titzak Eli? Why are you crying to me?" So it's a whole kasha. I mean, certainly, is God ruling out the notion of prayer, and is God ruling out the notion of fighting? I mean, after all, throughout the desert, we were called upon to engage in war, and that's the rule of you don't rely on miracles and the like, and certainly prayer, you know, you never discourage. I mean, the short answer is that it is a question of a time and place, meaning HaKadosh Baruch Hu said, I have chosen this experience to demonstrate in a miraculous way my love for the Jewish people. Consequently, you are not to diminish the miraculousness of the experience by seeking alternative. No, because it was already told. I mean, Hashem already said B'nai Israel should go. See, if you look at the Pesukim, Hashem had already said they should go in. And then they start complaining, we can't do that, let's fight. And the Taina, yes, they were already told to go into the war. Well, okay, the Pesuk is a little less clear. Certainly Moshe was already told to tell them to go into the war. Now, the Pasuk does not clearly communicate that he had told them. That is something that's missing. However, many Mephorshim learn that the simple meaning is Moshe had promptly communicated what God had told him, and then he starts getting these four groups that are fighting over it. But clearly, Hashem already told Moshe that B'nai Israel should go into the water. If he didn't tell them, or that they didn't respond. Well, this might be the first time. This is not the only time. I mean, throughout the Midbar, we have a problem of B'nai Yisrael not always responding to Moshe. And once again, you know, according to some Midrashim, it's not for us to talk about inadequacies of leadership, but it does go back to the fact that Moshe was indeed a reluctant leader. And to some degree, that reluctance may have permeated his mission throughout his life. I don't want to say he was not comfortable, it's not to talk that way, but he had a certain reluctance, he had a certain reticence, and consequently perhaps that did affect the way people were able to respond to him at different times. Yeah.
So back to the unity, and that being some sort of a group, doesn't the Rambam and Tshuva also emphasize that, if you want to...
That's very excellent. The Rambam mentions, he enumerates various sins for which a Jew does not get a share in the world to come, unless he does tshuva on them. And one of those sins is not even a sin, so to speak. It's simply called poresh midarchei hatzibur, one who intentionally separates himself from thinking about the Jewish people. So even if he keeps all the commandments, but if he does not concern himself with the needs of other Jews, it doesn't bother, meaning the Rambam even says, what happens to them doesn't bother him. Just doesn't bother him. The Rambam says such a person does not get Olam Haba, meaning redemption in a spiritual sense requires that connection to fellow Jews.
Isn't it that Bizkut Avod ever saved?
Well, it's a combination of a lot of things. There's the covenant, in fact, there are different things. There is the promise Hashem made to the Avos. There is the merit of the Avos. There is the fact that they didn't change their names and language. There is the fact that they had Pesach and Mila. Hashem, we were so in such a difficult situation, Hashem had to combine many, many different ingredients to be able to redeem us. And certainly one of those ingredients was the unity that existed among the people. But I want to share with you a thing about these four groups, a very interesting thoughts on this concept of what these four groups represents. And I have two explanations. One explanation is an individual explanation as it applies to people as individuals, and the other is more of a political explanation, how it applies to the nation, the Jewish people as a whole. The individual explanation is taken from a very famous sefer. You may have heard of the sefer. It's called Toldos Yaakov Yosef. Toldos Yaakov Yosef was the first printed sefer of Chassidus that was ever written. Rav Yaakov Yosef of Polonia was a disciple of the Baal Shem Tov. He and the Maggid of Mezrich, but he was the first great disciple of the Baal Shem Tov. Of course, he was born in Misnagid, because anyone that was a Talmud Baal Shem Tov was born in Misnagid. The Baal Shem Tov was born in Misnagid, as it were. And the Toldos Yaakov Yosef is on Chumash, and virtually all that we know from the Baal Shem Tov are the quotations in the book. He quotes the Baal Shem Tov close to 500 times. So this is really considered to be a contemporaneous account. Many thought at the time that he would have become the successor of the Baal Shem Tov. He did not. And part of the reason he did not was he was very acerbic and extremely critical of non-Hasidic rabbis. I mean, it's really a very strongly anti-rabbinical text in many ways, talking about the arrogance of the rabbis and the fact they don't care about the common people. He was very, very tough and critical, as opposed to the Mezritch or Maggid, who was a more gentle temperament. So I think the Baal Shem Tov figured that the Maggid would be the better person to spread the movement than the Toldos Yaakov Yosef. But be it as it may, the Toldos Yaakov Yosef is a very authoritative book on the early teachings of Hasidus. And it's in print. You can get it. I don't think it's ever been translated. But in the Akdama to the Toldos Yaakov Yosef, I'm adapting it a little. I'm not saying it exactly the way he says it, but he adopts an approach in which he says that the Yam Suf can be understood not just as an ocean, but it's the torrential waves of life that threaten to engulf us, right? Like life is sometimes like a stormy sea in which we have to have a path to navigate. And in fact, we find in Shir HaShirim that torrential water is also a metaphor for the Umos HaOlam trying to destroy us. The love that we have for God is compared to a fire. And it says in Shir HaShirim, Mayim Rabim Lo Yuchlu L'Chabos Es Ha'ava. Torrential waters cannot extinguish the fire of love. What is that torrential water? All the persecution of the Umos HaOlam. So he says the following. Chazal taught, again Greek philosophers, it goes back to Aristotle and even before, that matter is comprised of the basic four elements. Again, we don't quite view it that way today, but the basic four elements that were identified in the ancient world as the foundation of matter is we have air, fire, water, and soil, dirt. Right? These were the four yesodos, the four elements. And in Aristotelian teaching, these are also the four fluids or the four humors of the body, and illness comes when there's an excess of one element that predominates over the other element, etc. Now, in a spiritual sense, Rav Yaakov Yosef says, the foundation of fire is that which on one hand is passion, that's the good part of it, but that is what leads to anger, jealousy, and machlokas. Right? So an abundance of eish, the yesod ha'eish, leads to machlokas. Water is self-indulgence and pleasure. So when it's in its proper balance, it's appreciation and happiness. In an improper balance, it's hedonism and an abundance of pleasure. The yesod of afor, of dirt, leads to depression, despondency, and sadness. And of course, in the right proportion, it's modesty. And finally, the yesod of ruach, spirit, represents that which is self-esteem, the ruach, but if it's taken to the wrong way, it could be yesod of gaiva, of arrogance, right? So eish leads to jealousy and machlokas, mayim leads to an abundance of taiva, of hedonism and self-indulgence, afar leads to depression and inadequacy, and ruach leads to arrogance, right? When you have, when the body, or the spiritual soul, remember the Rambam, as the Rambam's famous description in his introduction to Pirkei Avos, which we begin reading this week, is that spiritual problems are given an illness description, meaning the soul is out of whack because there's too much of one factor in the soul that you need to get in balance and equilibrium. So he says like this. He says, this is a metaphor, again, this is an early Hasidic drasha. He says that those people that said, let us jump into the sea, are those people that are taken over by water. Water dominates in their lives in an excessive way. And that's the Yetzirah of hedonism and self-indulgence. Too much water, too much pleasure. Those that say, let us wage war, are those who are motivated by the fire of anger and machlokas. And those who say, let us return to Egypt and be abject slaves, are those who are dominated by afor, by dirt, in which there's a lack of self-esteem and depression. And those who say, let us call out, that's using your air, that is the idea of arrogance and gaiva. Therefore he says, what is dysfunctional about these responses is people are taken over by the various four elements, and they're pulled in extremities that lead to spiritual imbalance and spiritual instability. Now again, according to him, it has nothing to do directly with the Yamsuf, but it's taken as a secondary message for the need of harmony and balance among the multiple spiritual forces within a Jewish personality. So that again is how he understands in a metaphorical way the notion of the four groups. But I think we can also take it a little further and perhaps even give a communal and political message to this. And that is, if we look at the Yom Suf as the confrontation with the secular world out there, the great ocean that can extinguish our love for God, the four responses, all of which are condemned, might represent four different ways that Jewish communities have tried to deal with what is known as the Jewish problem. Like there's a phenomenon that was known historically as the Jewish problem. Right? Herzl was addressing the Jewish problem, and that is, we live in a world, frankly, where we are hated. Right? Throughout history, Jews have been hated, Jews have been persecuted, Jews have been despised. And anti-Semitism is a mysterious phenomenon in many, many ways. Like, you know, why? Why exactly? Is it connected to the belief of the Catholic Church that Jews killed God, or they rejected Jesus? Does it have other reasons? Again, people still wonder and ponder. Does it come because Jews don't keep the Torah? Which is one thing the Torah seems to say, you don't keep the mitzvahs, you'll have hatred. And yet there's a Chazal that says, no, Sinai. Why is Mount Sinai called Sinai, which is etymologically related to sin-ah, hatred? Because of the Torah, the nations hate us, right? So sometimes you see in Chazal, hatred comes when we leave the Torah. Sometimes you see in Chazal, hatred comes when we keep the Torah. But however we define why this phenomenon of anti-Semitism exists, there are four ways that Jews have historically tried to respond to it, four wrong ways, because these are wrong ways. Way number one is simply by attempting to assimilate. Right? The one short answer is, if people hate us because we're different, because we're unique, then maybe if we simply try to become the same, they're not going to hate us anymore because we'll be the same. To a large extent, political Zionism in the 19th century, in fact this goes back to the state of the Jews, was not an attempt to be distinct, but it was an attempt to be normal, to be like everybody else. Let's have a country like everybody else. Achad Ha'am, who's actually a romantic in many ways, but he made the famous statement that we will not really achieve our status of being Umos Ha'olam until we have our own Ganavim, our own murderers, our own bank robbers. Then we will have made it. Well, we have made it, indeed. So I guess we've achieved a modicum of success in that. So the truth of the matter is that response number one is, let us be like the Umos Ha'olam. Let us assimilate, let us get rid of anything that is unique and distinctive about us, and that will solve our problems. That is represented by jumping into the ocean, embracing it, taking it on, spiritually giving up who you are. Huh? Spiritual suicide, that's right. Now, the truth of the matter is, I mean, not that one could ever say there's anything good about the Holocaust, it's not for us to say that, but one of the lessons that we learned in this century is that assimilation is not going to end anti-Semitism. Because in Nazi Germany, we certainly saw the phenomenon that Jews, well, as you know, a woman that is up for canonization in the Catholic Church was a Carmelite nun who was killed in Auschwitz because she was born a Jew. So what that tells you is that on some level,
one cannot escape Judaism or their identity as a Jew by simply assimilating. It'll come back. But nevertheless, in the 19th century, which was a more optimistic time historically, people believed, perhaps as the wife, and even Herzl. And again, I think Herzl had some ambiguity. It's really not a simple question. We like to say Herzl had no Jewish feelings. I mean, in his book, there were various Jewish feelings in which it could be shown that he did envision a Jewish state, but you know, we do know that at one point he was willing to take Uganda instead of Israel, mm-hmm. and at another point he offered the Pope that he would bring a whole bunch of Jews who would convert to Christianity if the Pope would lend his support to a Jewish state. We'll all convert, that would be fine. You know, and of course in the 19th century it was very, very common for Jewish academics, or this, in order to get a tenured position, needed to be officially Christian. They would just, you know, become Christian. It made no difference to them because, you know, they weren't practicing one religion or the other. So response number one is spiritual suicide by jumping into the water. That's response number one. Total secular assimilation. Response number two is let us return to Egypt. Now what does it mean to return to Egypt? Now this is interesting because response number two might be the response that many of us have. And that is, if response number one is assimilation, response number two might be called fragmentation. And that is where you live a double life. You have your little Dalai Lamas, you have your home, you have your shul, just like a slave has a hut, in which you can keep your religion. But then you go out into the world, and you're a totally integrated member of modern society, and you don't bring a religious perspective to what you do. Meaning, Moses Mendelssohn epitomized this, his famous declaration, be a Jew at home and a citizen of the world in the street, in the marketplace. And this really is a situation I think many of us find ourselves in which, you know, we fragment or compartmentalize our existence, in which in so much of the day we don't really think of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And of course it's very difficult. How do you bring religious perspectives to the way we do our work, to the way we do other things? And I don't mean overt religion. I don't mean, of course, you get up and you preach to people. I mean, that's not the issue. But the question is to try to be conscious that I have to make a Kiddush Hashem in what I do. And when I work in order to serve Hashem properly, etc. But the notion of fragmentation is you create a part of your life which you use to serve Hashem, and then the rest of your life you're a slave to Egypt. That's the notion of slavery, schizophrenia, compartmentalization, not bringing your Judaism to bear in how you live the rest of your life. That's why you can have the phenomenon of people who might be very religious and then unethical in their business, because they literally have a mindset, well, business is business and this is that, nothing to do with each other, two different lives, I am multiple people. And that is the chisaron of response number two. Let me be a slave in Egypt, meaning I have my hut, I have my privacy, but during the day I work for another master. The truth is you can't have two masters, there's only one master. Now response number three, let us wage war, is a response that people might take, which we might call voluntary ghettoization, where a person might look at the secular world and say, it is so bad, it is so evil, it is so corrupt, I will wage an unrelenting struggle against that world. And I will not allow any of it to permeate. This, in other words, if the problem of what you might call centrist Orthodox people is the fragmentation and schizophrenia, the waging of the war would be, let's say, what you would do in Williamsburg or something like that, in which you basically say, no secular education, no secular books, no secular culture, I'm keeping it all out because it's treif and it's bad and it's going to undermine. Now, that might be a legitimate choice as a lesser of two evils, but it's not an optimal choice. Meaning the concept is, HaKadosh Baruch Hu does say, Chazal teach us, that even though there is no Torah among Goyim, but there is Chochmah by Goyim. Chochmah means there is wisdom, there is insight, there is understanding. A person's life can be enriched by various insights that one gains. And the truth of the matter is, total ghettoization is not possible. I mean, after all, Hasidim have telephones.
I mean, they're not going to use anything of the modern world. I mean, even the Amish are, you know, are as close as you could be, but, you know, I don't know if they have phones or not, but they do different, you know, they obviously have some concession to some technology, as it were. But be it as it may, it's not just a question of technology, but the waging of the war, the unrelenting exclusion, is considered to be a failure in one's ability to totally appreciate the goodness and the beauty and the wisdom that Hashem put into the world. So that's the dysfunction of response number four, number three, waging war. So in effect, response number one is total assimilation. Response number two is fragmentation and schizophrenia. Response number three is the opposite of total assimilation, and that is total rejection, ghettoization, which is also a chisaron because it takes a person away from the Chachma B'Gayim. Now again, the big danger is, once you open up the door, how do you guarantee what comes in and what doesn't come in? You know, now in Eretz Yisrael there's a big discussion about internet, the Eda Charedis, which, you know, their face comes out against everything all the time. Unfortunately, they overplay their cards sometimes because they answer so many things that nobody takes, you know, someone answers this and this and this and this and this and that. You see their wall posters. So after a while, people stop reading. You know, they answer going to a psychologist, etc., different things. But they did issue a proclamation, among their many proclamations, that one is not allowed to use the internet. You know, not allowed to use the internet, what type of shtus is that? But the truth of the matter is, if one is aware as to what is available on websites and everything else, much, much worse than, you know, than movies or television or anything else. There's tremendous, tremendous, awful, awful things. And the question then becomes, you know, what do you do? These are useful, there's useful things, tremendously destructive things. And if you get any type of filter, you know, the kids will figure it out before the adults. And then you have adults doing things too, which aren't proper. You know, so we live in a life in which once you open up the door, is there any control at all? And what type of wisdom does it take to be able to create an environment which is open and receptive to things in modern society that are indeed ennobling and good and enriching? But at the same time, how to shield out that which is destructive? You know, Thomas Paine, one who the propagandist for the American Revolution, wrote a famous saying that he said that the price of liberty is eternal vigilance. And that's very true for spiritual liberty as well. There is an eternal vigilance in keeping the door open, but also standing by the door to be sure what goes in. Rav Huttner once pointed out that this is the meaning of two fundamental structures, buildings in the Torah. There is the Teva, which is the Ark of Noach, and there's the Mishkan. What is the difference between the Teva and the Mishkan? The Teva is designed to keep the bad people out. You build this Teva, you hermetically seal the Teva so that that richest of the world does not enter. The Mishkan was a source of light and Kedusha that is designed to radiate outwards. There are times in our lives we have to construct an ark to be safe from that flood which will engulf us. But the ultimate goal is not to be self-contained, but to allow the light and holiness to radiate outwards and influence others. So the point is, therefore, that even this third response of waging war is might be necessary sometimes, but it's not the perfect shlemus. Now the fourth response is
schizophrenia.
Yep.
The
schizophrenia, though. Okay, I'll come to that.
Aren't we on many levels subject to that kind of lifestyle?
Well, as I say, schizophrenia might be the normal way that we're operating.
Yeah.
But there is a problem. I'll mention what the right thing might be.
When you think schizophrenia, you think something dysfunctional and deviant, but you can think that schizophrenia is kind of that vigilant balance.
Yes, but that's not. But that's a separate thing. Meaning schizophrenia, in the sense that we're talking about, is when you're on an all-or-nothing mode. Meaning to say, when I do this, I do this.
Right.
When I do that, I'm not conscious of my connection to Hashem. That's different. I'll talk about the balancing, but the schizophrenia is the deliberate compartmentalization, where there is, right, when there's no carryover of your Jewish life into the other things that you do. But I'll discuss the notion of balance. Now, the fourth is interesting. The fourth were the people that said, let us call out to the world. This represents those people whose definition of Jewish identity depends on their victimization status. And here we have an issue. You know, if you ever go to a college campus and you put up two signs, one is you want to give a shiur in Chumash or Gemara, and the other is we're having a rally against Louis Farrakhan at 12 noon, and many more people will go to the Farrakhan rally than will go to the Chumash thing. And part of the reason is because one of the things that brings Jews together is the anti-Semite. One of the things that gets Jews together is we are victims and we need to band together and never again and the like. That's why the Holocaust is a great, great unifier of Jews, simply because it allows us to have a common enemy, and we appeal to the world, either we appeal or we demand, it takes different forms. You have to take care of us because we have been victimized. But there's a big problem with that. When your Jewish affinity depends on your victimhood status, there comes a time in which you're tired of being a victim. I mean, even now we see, unfortunately, is the newer generations are less moved by the Holocaust because they say, you know, why do I have to be a victim? Victims are weak and passive and put upon. And the point is that many people's only Jewish identity is they don't know what they stand for. There's nothing positive in it. But we're Jews because people hate us. In fact, it's been well said, if anti-Semitism were to disappear miraculously tomorrow, there would be many Jewish organizations that are out of business because there's nothing else they stand for but to fight Jewish enemies. And there would be many Jews that have literally nothing to do with their lives in terms of Judaism. So, I am connected as a Jew because I am victimized, and I call on the nations of the world, whether it's United Nations or whatever it is, to stand up for my rights or build a Holocaust memorial or whatever it is. So the four responses, total spiritual suicide, fragmentation, schizophrenia, ghettoization, and professional victimization, politically represent various ways in which Jews try to find an identity for themselves and deal with the persecutions of the Umos HaOlam. In reality, all four of those responses are criticized by God as being inadequate and incomplete. What is the right response, so to speak? The right response is what Nachshon himself did, and that is jump into the water, which means on one level, confront the challenges of society, confront it, don't escape it, but at the same time, do so with faith in Hashem. In other words, not the spiritual jumping in of suicide, but in faith that Hashem will give you the strength and the perception to be able to balance and see what is good, what is not good, to have the vigilance of balancing, And again, I want to differentiate the schizophrenia from balancing, because it is a very different situation. The schizophrenia exists when I am engaged in the secular part of my life without a consciousness that this is a way of serving Hashem also. Now the Rambam writes, if a person works or sleeps or eats and consciously thinks in their mind, I am doing this to serve Hashem, then the working and the sleeping and the eating becomes a mitzvah. Now what do we mean, l'maisa? I'm serving Hashem. How am I serving Hashem? In many different ways. There are many different ways. You could say, well, I'm working to earn money, which I will use to do mitzvahs. I will endeavor in the way I conduct my business, the way I relate to people, to sanctify God's name and to give people the impression that living a Torah life is a noble endeavor. I will recognize I must be honest in what I do because this is the will of Hashem. These are conscious thoughts that you have. And then it becomes avodas Hashem. That's not schizophrenia. Schizophrenia is when the person's feeling is, well, I'm from, but when I do business, you know, I'll be like a shark like everybody else. Well, you feel it, yeah.
Kind of, you know, you're like in and out, and you mm-hmm. life. I mean,
right.
Except when you're out, you're still not religious, but there's
right.
constant changes.
No, undoubtedly, there's going to be stress. Now, the issue still becomes like this. You know, Nachshon represents the perfect response. Huh? No, because he jumped into the water, he was willing to confront. Well, we manifest it by having faith, by dealing with the world, by not trying to escape the world, by confronting that situation, and having faith that Hashem will give us the strength to deal with it. But Nachshon is the perfect response. Now, many of us are not perfect, right? All of us, I'll speak for myself, are not perfect. Now, the thing is, as a result, we have to choose in life very often the lesser of two evils. Now, it's still a legitimate debate. It is a legitimate debate whether a greater withdrawal from the world might be the lesser of the evils. Meaning to say, if we have to choose between confronting a world that has a strong power to drag us down, or withdrawing from that world, that would be a difficult decision that people have to make. Neither is optimal, right? Neither is optimal, and it may very well be that, listen, if I can only keep my Yiddishkeit strong by separation, that may have to be the way that one goes, but one has to recognize that one is, in other words, instead of kind of having a spiritual superiority with that, one might have to recognize that that might be an accommodation with the lesser of two evils. Yeah.
I was going to say that the withdrawal itself has to take into account the submission to the world. For instance, people who withdraw from the world, they don't have jobs and they live on welfare.
Right.
Living on welfare is participating in the world too.
Yes, that's very correct.
I think, you know, there really has to be a recognition that no matter what we do, even when we withdraw, we're participating in the world, we're taking advantage
yeah.
of the world.
Yeah.
And that, you know, there is no schizophrenia because although you might think, you know, well, now I can turn it off because now I'm not in my Jewish mode. To the guy you work with, you're always in your Jewish mode.
Of course. In fact, somebody once said, you know, there are certain rules in halacha that a Talmud Chacham shouldn't behave a certain way, at a higher standard, because people will cast aspersions. So there was a fellow who was doing something improper, and the Yeshua Salantra told him, you know, a Talmud Chacham shouldn't behave this way. So the person's response was, I'm not a Talmud Chacham. So he says, for the Goyim, you learn enough, he says, you know. So the point is that in certain matters, we all have to put ourselves up as if we were, you know, some big authority. But again, it's not just Goyim. I don't want to say that, you know, behave ethically so the Goyim, you know. The point is that this is serving Hashem. I mean, think about this. I think the Baal Shem Tov says this. We sometimes forget this. You know, the Torah gives us all sorts of mitzvahs. Honesty and business and everything else, you know. When we conduct our lives in accordance with these commandments, we are fulfilling the mitzvahs of Hashem exactly at that time. Now, if people say, I want to learn Gemara Bava Kama, which has all the laws about not cheating people in business and the like. Actually, the Toldot Shaqiyot, I think, said this is one of the statements that got him in big trouble. He said, I mean, this is not a normative statement, so don't take this as, I'm just quoting him. He actually says, it's a bigger mitzvah to go into business and fulfill the laws against stealing than to sit and learn about the laws about not stealing when you're not actually fulfilling them. I mean, this was one of the anti-rabbinic statements that was very controversial, but without saying is that they're bigger than learning or not, we don't want to say that. But nevertheless, there is a mitzvah that is being fulfilled. Every time you go through business and you conduct your business honestly, you are fulfilling numerous commandments in the Torah.
Gedolim always had a prenup, or the Kabbalah had a prenup. But this is a new phenomenon of wealth. And
there's a famous passage in the Rambam. The Rambam writes that anyone that wants to get money because he's sitting and learning and does not have a parnassah and he's getting his parnassah from the Torah, the Rambam writes that's a chilul Hashem. He's desecrating God's Torah. He is degrading the Torah by using the Torah for economic sustenance. And it's a very, very great aveh with the Rambam writes this. However, the Kesef Mishnah, which is the author of the Shulchan Aruch, already wrote in the 1500s, where already people were learning, he gave a long hetcher why that's so. And he basically says, already in his time he felt that people who were not capable of being great, great gedolim, and at the same time working in a parnassah, so it's necessary to give them the opportunity to develop. But that still doesn't necessarily mean everybody. And, in Eretz Yisrael now, there's a very interesting thing going on. In Eretz Yisrael, this is very, very interesting. It's a major, major, major change, which has just happened over the past few years. I mean, people have been whispering for many years, but it was never official. Now it's an official party line, so to speak. You know, the problem with in the Haredi community, the so-called ultra-Orthodox community, is that there was literally no concept of having any type of job. Quite seriously, it was not. Every single person was expected to join. Every single manager was expected to join the yeshiva system and do full-time learning. And what happened is the following: number one, there were people who were not cut out for full-time learning, but they had to hang around. So you had hangers-on in the yeshiva system. They, Baruch Hashem, have large, large families. There's no way of supporting. And what you have is you have 10 people a day coming to Silver Spring. Collecting for, what do you do? So you wind up collecting money because they weren't in the army. That's because they weren't allowed to get a job, etc., and they didn't have any training anyway. And for years, the official idea was everybody has to learn. Now, they just recently established institutions, not college, because they don't want to have liberal arts and things, but vocational schools, which now have the Haskama, Rebbe Yashiv, and the Gedolim. In fact, Rav Steinman of the Yeshiva Panovich, is going to be Rav Shach's successor, although he kind of is 89 himself. He came to America, and when he came to America, on a fundraising thing, he came back to Israel. He was the first one. He started talking about institutes for Parnassa, and he was attacked. Although he was a great gadol, but say, well, now that he's been to America, he must have been influenced by American ideas. They were disparaging him. But now it's been officially sanctioned. And that's tremendously important. And the reason is because people who are living in intergenerational poverty, like it's really like inner city situation, and people who were not cut out for learning, it's not just economically devastating, it was psychologically devastating. The person who went through life had no sense of a purpose. It was destroying some marriages. It was resulting in child abuse. Again, much, much, much smaller compared to regular society. But Chazal already say, if a person is batala, if a person has an aimlessness about them, that's going to cause all sorts of devastating things. So now the judgment is that many people should be directed into some type of vocational parnasa, and it's an excellent idea. The fear always is, this is always the fear, this is the fear in America as well, that by creating these options in which one could make, of course, not a lot of money, but a relatively lot of money by Israeli standards, are you going to be taking people away who could be the Gedolim, who could be the Rosh Hashivas, and are they going to be working and stuff? So this was the fear for 50 years. The fear was, well, listen, all right, maybe only 20% can really become these great people, but we have to put everybody in order to get our 20%. And if that means, a large percentage are going to be crushed, can't make an omelet without, breaking eggs, so to speak. Maybe they have to be the sacrifice. No, this was the calculation. And it's a difficult question. If in order to produce a Rav Aaron Cutler, you got to ruin, you know, maybe 100 people, you know, I don't know. It's very hard to say, but...
You know, it's interesting, you know, the generation that produced the Dolan, Rockefeller, there was a great generation there.
Yes.
They didn't have these values.
They didn't. That's correct. That's correct. On the other hand, well, you're right. You're right. There are many more people learning in yeshivas now than learnt in the golden age of Europe. There's no question.
But
the golden age of Europe. I understand, but part of it is.
I once talked to my grandfather about this in Poland, where he grew up. The town would pick one boy who was a real guy, and they would support the whole town.
That's right. That's right.
Because everybody would contribute. They were poor.
The average kid went to work at 15. Yeah, went to cheder. But keep in mind, number one, a few things. Number one, the cheder system itself was much more intensive. So even if you stopped learning at 15, you had a good background in Gemara, things that kids don't even begin learning Gemara till Bar Mitzvah or so. So you learned a lot. Number two, at least in the shtetl society, you were surrounded by a very intensity of religious life that could carry you through if you were a shoemaker or a cobbler or a tailor. And the question now becomes, when you live in a world that's much more secular, maybe people need yeshiva. You know, these are the issues. These are important issues. And I think the Gedolim have concluded that there has to be avenues for these alternatives. It's been done surreptitiously for a while, but now it's getting official sanction. Now it has the stamp of approval. And, you know, Toro is doing something in Israel very interesting, and, you know, it's based on that. And he's got, of course, separate men and women's, and, you know, they don't do philosophy or literature or nothing dangerous, but it's totally vocationally based. And I think it's a wonderful thing. I mean, I think it's a very, very worthy charity because after a while, you know, it's just it's really a ridiculous, tragic cycle. You know, parent to child to grandchild to great-grandchild. I mean, it's just poverty forever. And it's not that, I mean, people who spend half the year collecting money are not studying, you know, learning so much Torah either. So what's the ruchnius? What exactly is the gain?
It also brings in other bad values, like you want to marry your children off to somebody who's wealthy because you need some source of support.
Yeah, but the problem is that it's disappearing. I mean, that's the problem. The problem is, you know, you still have grandparents who had money, but as it keeps on going and going and going and going, the people that have money are diminishing. They're not even around anymore, you know, so it's like... I have it at home. I don't have the name in front of me, but I think it's a very important thing. I mean, it's what the Rambam says. The Rambam says, right, as you know, the greatest level of the eight levels of tzedakah is to give people the ability to make a living themselves. That is the highest level of tzedakah. This really is a worthy thing. But you're correct. I mean, what this highlights is that sometimes in our attempts to escape from the world, I think we find ourselves inextricably bound up with the world in often negative and destructive ways. So the notion of escape might be an illusion. But still, on other levels of escape, like do I have a television, do I have internet, do I do these things? These are things that one has to deal with. And the trouble is, you know, human beings are lazy. And sometimes if we can't have the energy to be with our kids 24 hours a day, there are easier ways of parking them in different places. And, you know, this is human and this is natural, but, you know, we have to at least be aware of the fact that these are high-risk, high-danger areas in which we should at least try to have some type of control and supervision. So, in a sense, these four responses represent the four different mistakes that Jews make in dealing with modernity and secularism. Yeah. Political Zionism actually, to a large degree, in its classic formulation, was a form of spiritual assimilation, because political Zionism, in the Herzl formulation, was an attempt at normalization, meaning we should be like the nations, meaning we're not having a country because we're different, we're having a country because we're the same, you see? So in that sense, it's a normal... Well, religious Zionism, you know, some might say, that depends on your stance, some might say religious Zionism is the Nachshon ben Aminadav response in which you confront modernity and you attempt to bring Hashem in it. So you don't have a clear condemnation of it. If you consider religious Zionism wrong, you would say that it ultimately leads to the sense of spiritual assimilation, because the argument is that when you press your identity on nationalism of any type, that ultimately causes you to forget Hashem. So it doesn't automatically fit in any of the four categories. The question is whether it leads to one of the four categories or not. Mm-hmm. Well, again, from my perspective, I consider it in a positive sense, in the sense that, in fact, Rav Kook said a beautiful idea. You know, many people said, how could Zionism be part of the coming of Mashiach if the leaders were so unreligious and they were so against the Torah? How could that be God's emissaries to bring something good to the Jewish people? That's right, that's right. And Rav Kook basically said that some people come to Eretz Yisrael because of their connection to Hashem, and others will come to Hashem because of their connection to Eretz Yisrael. And he says, the desire to connect to Eretz Yisrael, even as an expression of Jewish nationalism, comes from a desire of the soul to be close to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. They may not know it, and they may deny it, but Rav Kook said that came from a desire of the neshama to be close to Hashem. And once again, it seems to be very connected to Mitzrayim, that the identification with Jewish destiny is a foundation for redemption. What was Rav Kook's mashal? Rav Kook's mashal was, he gave a beautiful mashal when the Bezalel Art School opened up. You know, it's in... Rav Kook was always writing. I mean, Rav Kook was an optimist. I mean, some say he was overly optimistic. You know, when Hebrew University opened up, he gave a great speech about how this could be a religious center. And when the Bezalel Art School opened up, and, you know, people criticized art, we need art, you know, painting and sculpture, you know, this is not Torah. So Rav Kook wrote a letter in the 1920s, whenever it was, in which he gave the following mashal. He gave a beautiful mashal about a little girl that had a fever. And she was feverish, and she couldn't eat, and she couldn't sleep, and she was tossing and turning and crying. But the day comes when she wants her doll. And when she wants her doll, a doll is nothing, just a little minor thing. The parents are so overjoyed, because that is the sign that she's ready to take her steps back to health. And once she wants the doll, we'll be able to feed her and eat and take medicine and gain her strength. So Rav Kook said, it might very well be that art is like playing with a little doll. You know, get back the doll. But it's a source of great joy because it shows that the Jewish soul is recovering from all the pains of Golus. And once the little girl wants to play with the doll, you can then anticipate nourishment and medicine and exercise that will bring her back to health. So Rav Kook saw this turning to the aesthetic. And aesthetic, in many ways, is kind of a luxury. It's going beyond, you know, basic survival as a sign of the recovery of that soul and its openness to new things, which could be Torah and everything else. Right? This is what Rav Kook said. You know, so he saw all of these things. Huh? Yeah, he saw all of these things as beginning a process of healing which would create a receptivity to spiritual truth as well. Of course, one member of the audience, I heard this was said somewhere, said, well, they're still playing with the doll after 90 years, but okay. The truth is, you know, it's such a complicated thing. You know, things are not black and white. I mean, how much Torah is learned in Eretz Yisrael is amazing. How much the government supports Torah is amazing. No, anti-religious government, etc. I mean, how much money the government gives to yeshivas and everything else. And even the issue about the religious people in the draft, you know, this is not a black and white situation in which those who want to draft yeshiva people are the bad guys. I mean, the point is, this is a difficult issue that is being debated among the Torah scholars in whether some type of military service might be an appropriate thing as a contribution to the state and as a way of giving people good habits. That's what we talk about. I mean, Lahavdil, like you say, you know, inner city kids should go to the army because it straightens them out. I mean, there is this talk that this is a vehicle for discipline and hadracha. So this is not a good guy, bad guy situation. This is a difficult, difficult issue. On one hand, it's true that army life, to a large extent, could undermine some religious values. On the other hand, you have Hester, who create Kiddush Hashem. On the other hand, there's a need to contribute to the security of the state. On the other hand, Haredim would have so many special needs that there's no way to accommodate them. It's a very, very hard question. So the notion of demonizing, you know, government as all bad guys, etc., is just not true. And that's not even the right. I think people are beginning to understand that these are multidimensional problems.
Don't these vocational schools kind of get in the way of the exemption from the draft?
Yes, it has to be worked out legally. In order to establish the vocational school, there's going to have to be some compromise on the issue of the draft, which is, you know, is presently being debated. Whether perhaps, what do they want to say? They want to, different proposals. Maybe 20% of the elite yeshiva would get a total exemption, and the rest would go through basic service, which is basic training, which is 6 months, and then be called up on reserve. You know, they're not talking about a full 3-year commitment, but they're trying to work out some type of compromise. And if that basic service or basic training is completed, they'll be able to go to vocational school. Right? So it's all a package that has to be worked out. But it shows you that kind of the old, you know, black and white, even among the most Haredim now, is being understood that you have to deal with it on many levels. I think it is. I think it is the ideal, simply because the alternative is for many, not for all, aimlessness and depression and being dependent on others. This is a much better ideal. Well, that's right. That's why. I mean, people are worried. It's a scary time because it is a major readjustment of the norm. In America, in a sense, we're used to it a little bit more. For us, you know, people go to college, people get jobs, but there it's a real big, it's a big shock. It's a big shock. I mean, where I lived, I didn't know any Israeli that had a job. I mean, I didn't know. I mean, I knew there were lawyers, and I guess, you know, but I didn't meet any. You know, I was not, in my neighborhood, I would not be aware that anyone had had a job at all. You know, it was very, very... I shouldn't say not a job. I mean, there were people I knew. There were rebbeim I knew. I mean, people at Jeff. But either you were a rebbe or you were in Kolo. Those were the only... there was one doctor in the neighborhood who was a doctor. American doctor.
Where were you?
Arzia Birash, one of them. Nobody had a regular. Okay. Now, I did spend some Shabbosos in Katamon, where I did meet... a working class, but not, yeah.
I just wanted to say, you have to be attentive to the beginning of the blue line. It's on air right before Pesach, for the arbiter ring, was having a dinner,
mm-hmm.
kosher and
kosher. Oh, wow, I'll tell you, amazing. Amazing. See, they used to have the Yom Kippur dances. That's right.
I wanted to go back to the first example that you gave of the spiritual side of the body.
Yeah, uh-huh.
Maybe they did assimilate, but I think that part they were waging war as well because they had a ferocity about what they were trying to do. They wanted to prove something.
Right.
They were very hard at it. And assimilation is sort of implies, you know, kind of capitulating, you know, not showing the difference. I think that they were very much about trying to show that Jews are as good.
Yeah.
Well, Jewish farmers.
You know, there are two schools of thought within Zionism. One is perhaps identified with Herzl very often, and the other is identified with Achad Ha'am. Achad Ha'am is called the romantic stream of Zionism, in which Herzl wanted to show Jews are the same as everybody, and Achad Ha'am wanted to show kind of, and Ben Gurion took over the Achad Ha'am vision a little bit when Ben Gurion said, Let Israel be a light unto the world. Now, not in a religious sense, but at least in some type of moral sense, that our morality has to be a beacon of light. So that expression of Zionism, which really was Ben-Gurion's vision, was the sense of... Ben-Gurion was a big student of the Bible. He didn't believe in the Gemara that much, but the morality of the Tanakh, to be Or LaGoyim, etc. Herzl's vision was much more, not just be like everybody else. That's why I have to check the famous quote that Achad Ha'am says, that, you know, when we have our own Ganavim, in a way, I think Achad Ha'am may have been parodying Herzl, because it doesn't sound like Achad Ha'am's own sentiment would have been in that direction. So there are two different views, the idealistic one, or the notion of we'll be like everybody else. But even we'll be like everybody else was done with a certain passion that we don't have. But after a while, you know, it wears away, because if the concept is we want to be like everybody else, and after 50 years we're still behind New York, the person figures, gee, let me go to New York. I mean, I can be. Why do I have to be like everybody else in Tel Aviv? I can be like everybody else in New York and get more out of it. You know, that's a big big crisis. So many have said the only true Zionists today in Israel are the religious people who come out of a sense of commitment to the country. You know, that creates a lot of problems. Okay, I don't want to be too political, but okay, have a good
week. We'll see you next week.